Welcome to School for Startups Radio. We are so cram-packed today, we don't have time to run our normal introduction. Three great guests. Let's go ahead and get started. Very excited to introduce my first guest. It's quite a story. Please welcome Jared Lopiccolo to the show. He is the co-founder and CEO of Noble Studios, which is a digital creative marketing performance company. We'll figure out what all that means. He has amazing clients like Google, Adobe, Disney, and has won a huge list of awards. There was like 20 listed from Inc. and Ad Age and other industry things. He is a very dynamic speaker with hundreds of speaking engagements, and he's been on all of the big podcasts. We're the last to get him. Jared, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Jim. Thank you. And that was a great intro. So I appreciate it. I'm going to have you introduce me to, you know, anyone and everyone moving forward. But no, thanks to having you on the show today.
Yes. I also offer a service. I'll walk around and say that whenever we go into a new room. And
there you go.
Throw in world renowned lover.
You know, there you go. I love that.
We got to make the important things, right?
So. Yes, of course.
All right. You grew from a small shop to as big and prestigious as you can get with Disney as a client. Tell us the story. Very impressive.
Yeah. Run. Yeah. Thank you. You know, I think just growing up underneath other entrepreneurs, my father was an entrepreneur. My mother was, you know, their parents were. I think the idea of just, you know, serving people, you know, identifying a demand that's out there, and serving them, but also just doing it with, you know, and I'm recently reading this great book called Unreasonable Hospitality, but doing it with an unreasonable sort of expectations that we set on ourselves, really providing that, you know, that white glove customer service. And so that could really be in any industry, but we just happened to choose, my wife and I, when we started the business, we just happened to choose, you know, marketing and helping effectively build the internet to kind of bring people closer together and more meaningful connections.
All right. So what kind of marketing do you do? That term is almost becoming meaningless now. It's got to have 19 adjectives first. So give us the 19 adjectives.
I know. Right. I know. And we used to, and we still say digital once in a while, but otherwise, you know, hopefully all marketing is both digital and physical and traditional. But yeah, we started the company building websites effectively. Over the years, we've, you know, really grown into a full service agency, serving a lot of those Fortune 100, 500 clients with really just all forms of marketing. So whether we start with brand strategy and then we move into, you know, sort of promotion, performance marketing. So that could be the SEOs or the SEM or, you know, CRO. And obviously now we're working in the GEOs, right? So all the answer engines and really getting yourself to show up in those. But then outside of that, just truly still building on our roots of building digital experiences, you know, for our clients. So yeah, we're a full service agency. We prefer to lean on the digital side of activation because we can pivot so quickly. We can get data, you know, really accurate data on our clients, customers, and really try to work towards providing it, what we call is a valuable personalized experience, also known as VPEs. It's a term that we're starting to kind of bring to market. And that's really just about getting the customers what they want, when they want it, at the right time.
How far away are we from AI marketing to make sure that you appear high and well respected in all of the AI answers?
Yeah. So, well, we work in a lot of the travel and tourism space as well, outside of, you know, some of the major brands that people recognize. And what we're seeing on that front, because of itinerary building and all these other ways of getting inspiration before visiting a destination, is that the SERPs, the search engine results pages, are losing some of that market share to these AI engines. And what we're seeing, though, which is, it's actually really quite interesting, is that while there's less traffic organically going to some of these websites, because the answer engines are effectively providing these answers, the traffic that does go to these sites are super engaged. They convert, you know, much higher. They stay on your site much longer, and those ultimately become those sort of long-term, you know, advocates or brand ambassadors for you. So yeah, the short version is, you know, these SERPs, Googles, and everything else, they're losing some of that market share the websites are losing market share to those, but even more so, Google and whatnot are losing that market share to those answer engines. But like I said, we're seeing some really good results of the traffic that does come through.
Very interesting. So what's going on with Disney?
I knew you asked that, you had that word in there. I thought, oh, this is a hot topic. You know, yeah,
it's tough. There was an article about them being empty.
I know. It's crazy. Well, I mean, just read this one today that basically, you know, they lost in the course of, 24 hours, $4 billion, effectively what they paid for in terms of, you know, the acquisition of Star Wars. But if you watch the stock market, they're one of the bigger, more high performing stocks today because of now Jimmy's back. And so that's the tough part when you get so large, right, as a company, that you really do have so many subsidiary companies that got their hands in everything that, you know, at one point, one of those companies can make a mistake and it can affect your entire, you know, portfolio. So I think we're seeing the effects of that. And I'm glad to hear and see that, you know, Jimmy is back on and this perceived, you know, concern of free speech is no longer an issue. And that, you know, we've got our, you know, our fun comedians back.
Yes. It'll be interesting. Is he funny though, Jared? I don't know about that part.
I know. Yeah, that's the debate, right? It's tough because, you know, no matter which, you know, side of the fence you're on, I think we all want the same thing, which is this element of, you know, free speech. That's what this, you know, country was founded on. But at the same time, we got to be careful that we don't toe the line so far that, you know, if you will, like support or celebrate political violence. And so we've got to be really careful about, you know, what we do. I mean, you remember back in the day, you know, you have some of these talk show hosts, you know, Howard Stern's and stuff weren't allowed to talk about stocks because they would effectively, you know, interrupt the market. And all of a sudden they cause one stock to drop or one to rise. So we're in a pretty lucid and transparent world these days that you know, things we say can make a big difference, good or bad.
Yes, but we still have to have the ability to tell whatever jokes we want, you know?
I know.
And I have a huge problem with the government telling the networks what to do.
I agree.
What to do. I can't remember the last time I watched Kimmel. It must have been 10 years ago or something on the internet. You know, I certainly haven't watched the show. And so I don't know. All of that's very scary.
It is scary. I mean, I think at the end of the day, we want to, give people, I mean, America is built on this concept of, you know, anything's possible. You can come here with $5 in your pocket, you know, and you can become a billionaire. And I think we need to make sure that what we founded on, right, was this element of entrepreneurship and anything's possible, that we preserve that. And of course, obviously our first amendment, I mean, we've just got to be careful, right, as we toe the line. And I always found that, you know, the private market is going to drive innovation. It's going to drive, you know, the direction of the company. And then government really needs to sit back and help with some of that regulation so that things don't, you know, become monopolized or, you know, we don't do anything nefarious or that can put ourselves at risk. But the reality is we need that private market to continue to push us towards innovation.
But on another level, let's go back to Disney.
Yes,
they have lost their community. They have alienated their core customer at like 9 different levels. You know, I am their core customer. And I am pissed at them, and I haven't, you know, I have gone recently.
Yes.
But that was only because I was going to Epic first, you know, and so I was in town. But they have lost their core, and they have gained a reputation of a price problem that is just too expensive. So as part of their marketing team, what would you recommend a company like that do?
Well, I think, Jim, and this is a really good point because I feel like this applies to almost any company, right, where you have a brand, you know, affiliation or relationship with. And I think when you think of brands, you know, the best experience you have with a brand you know, it should be celebrated. And then when you have the worst experience with a brand, you need to look at that as well and say, well, how was that? Right. And then a neutral experience. And ideally, right, whether you have the best or worst, you should have a consistent experience with that brand and you should trust that brand. And I think as we get into a more me-centric, you know, sort of market, right, it's been kind of moving that way. Everyone's a little bit more self-centered and a little bit focused on themselves more, you know, and we've lost some of that institutional sort of trust. We're going to get that from brands, right? We as humans still need that. So we're naturally going to go towards brands that have similar value systems or, you know, promote things that we care about or affiliations or problems in the world. If they're solving climate change and you care about that, you're going to gravitate towards that kind of brand. And these brands need to make sure that they're consistent in their best times and their worst times and when they're just sort of sitting idle. So I guess when you think about Disney, right, they've lost, to your point, they've messed up. They've lost a chunk of their audience. They need to either look to regain that audience, and they've got to do that through multiple touch points to build that trust back, or they've got to seek a net new audience that, you know, and they got to figure out how to appeal to that. But make no doubt about it that that audiences shift, audiences adjust, companies adjust. So I have faith that Disney will be able to rebuild their base of audiences. It just might not be the same people. It might be different. They might have to generate, you know, different types of shows that would then attract a net new base. But in general, brands ebb and flow with their base. You know, that just naturally happens. It's just, you know, can they survive a big enough hit, you know, without kind of like letting go of the infrastructure that everyone comes to like and respect of a brand like Disney?
I don't know. I think they're going to have to get a new CEO. I think we're in a world now where there's so much information and so many people are diving into the information. There are so many Disney adults that are following the situation so closely, and they don't like management anymore. And they're sophisticated enough that they don't like management three layers deep. You know, they don't like the replacement guy either. So anyway, what are the cores to running a great shop? What makes it award winning and all those awards? Is it the ping pong table?
Well, I think those are all sort of like byproducts. I think, you know, at the end of the day, a culture is in people, right? People are the variable. They separate a good company from a great company. And I think that you can definitely craft a culture, but then it has to sort of live organically, you know, on its own. And I think what the root of what bonds our culture together is this concept of meaningful connections. And it's that actually everyone, you know, is effectively equal, right? In that whether you're, you know, come from this color or this culture or this age group or demographic, at the end, we all kind of want similar things, right? We want to listen to our music. We want to watch our shows. We want to be around family, and we want to celebrate holidays with friends. We want to tap into nostalgia. We all have that as our similar tenants. And our job as leaders, you know, whether you're running this company, whether you, Jim, are running your company or others, it's our job is, I think, to bring together humans and have a meaningful connection with them. And that really means having an authentic connection with them. So finding out, like giving a crap about those people, right? Finding out what their interests are, where they have pain, and being empathetic or sympathetic when those moments happen. But I think that is what really bonds us together. And then once you have that foundation, then you can do anything, right? You can run an agency, you can run, you know, a Tupperware company, you can run a shipping company. It doesn't matter what the end result is, as long as you found that ability to like bond us all together, you know, and ideally then you're also, you know, attached with a similar value system as well, that will then give it the longevity that businesses need to survive. But at the end of the day, truly it comes down to the people and a set of value systems, and we all care about each other and our family and our friends and want the best, you know, for all of us.
Have you spent time defining, creating a culture?
Yes. Yes, we have, Jim. And
describe.
And please. So in the early days, and this, you know, we're going on 22 years now, if you don't mind me telling a quick story, I think.
Please,
you know,
radio's best love of story.
Yeah. Well, it, you know what it is when you start out, you have this demand, you have this trade, you have this gift that you can, and you found a demand for it and you can sell it. And so you're sort of rogue, you know, at first you're just filling this demand and you're doing it at all costs. You're saying yes to everything. And this is a pretty normal entrepreneurial journey, unless you've been backed and you have, you know, private equity money and you've got this real goal. You've already sold what the vision of the company is going to be, but you really are just filling this demand with a trade secret you have, or you're better than your other tradespeople around you. And then once you start to realize, well, we actually have something of value, maybe it's a few years in, then you start establishing systems and you start establishing processes, you know. And for us, what we found was that and why we called our company Noble, was Noble Studios, was it really rested on this core value, right? Of that nobility is not a birthright. It's something you earn every day. You know, you're to anticipate someone else's needs. You're to lean in and, you know, and do what's right, even if it means that you don't end up on top, like all those kinds of things. And so what we found for us, it was that when you have a value-based system, when you have a principle, when you have principles and you're a purpose-driven company, that really can bring you into the future. And we knew going into digital marketing that this was going to be an ever-changing landscape, that we were going to operate on a 30% learning curve, which a lot of people still have to operate in, whether you're in this space or not. But we knew we needed something that was going to give us a moment to say, you know, is this the noble thing to do? Or, hey, you know, one of our core values is empower others. Are we really empowering others in this? So that helps us build the right type of culture and, you know, career development. So really what we founded the company on, we didn't realize it, but that we were a principally led, purpose-driven company. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs, you know, when they get to that moment of saying, okay, I've fulfilled this demand in market, now it's actually time to kind of grow up and be a company that can live a lot longer, much beyond even myself. And, you know, ideally this becomes not a legacy company, but it could become a company that lives for quite a long time because it has so many systems and values and processes and the fact that it's built up on principles. And so that would be any sort of recommendation for anyone telling that story, is to not just find that demand, but then how do you go a couple layers deeper? Because that's what's going to keep you in the game the long time.
Where are you located, Reno?
Yeah, so I'm in Carson City, Nevada. It's the state capital of Nevada. Our business is in Reno, and we have an office in Vegas, and we have an office in the UK. And part of reason why we wanted to get into the UK was really to extend our products, services, and experiences to those brands, those bigger brands that we're working for, and vice versa. For those that wanted to enter into the American market, you know, with a service or goods, we open an office over there. And so we have about 75 employees in total, and yeah, just really packing a punch.
Very impressive. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Not having an office in Silicon Valley or Los Angeles with your media have any impact? Do you have an easier or a harder time getting employees to want to come to Reno?
Yeah, that, you know, this is something we talk a lot about. And Jim, I'll tell you, it was actually an advantage. I always talk about like what a creative, you know, hack, you know, ultimately could be. And I think about a constraint, and I always like a good constraint, or, you know, or to remove constraints. But with us being in the Reno Tahoe area, it was a constraint on us 22 years ago when we started the business, because to your point, Silicon Valley was this tech mecca. But what was awesome about the position is that we would just go over the hill and we would meet with our contacts. And I would say things like, yeah, we're inshoring it, making jokes, because at the time offshoring had a negative connotation to it. And I would say, hey, we're in the same time zone. Also, our cost of living is less. So, we, you know, we're 25% less than the Silicon Valley, you know, team members. And in that time, though, we had to grow our talent. We looked at it as a crop and saying, okay, nobody, it, you know, understands HTML5, for instance, when that first came out, or, you know, fill in the blank for whatever technology was there. So we used our clients and our team, and we created what was called Noble University. And we basically trained and upskilled our employees, because they didn't, you know, coming out of the Reno market, they just weren't known, you know, to have this sort of tech background. unlike, you know, the Silicon Valley. So it became really that constraint of us being there became actually a selling point as to why people wanted to work with us. Cause we also, you know, lived and played and we, you know, represented the normal American family that everyone had a house and a backyard. And here people are in, you know, in high rises, you know, in Silicon Valley. So I think it became a strength of ours. And I would always encourage people to look and say, okay, what is your deficiency or what is your perceived, constraint, and how do you flip that and make that your sort of strength?
Good answer. Good thought. And that is, almost like the Walmart philosophy that they have now created Bentonville as a mecca to live in. And it's an amazing place to live now with more museums per capita than any other place in the world or something.
That's right. Well, and you think about this with all of them, all the major companies, the Hartfords and the Kohlers, and you know, they there were constraints against them. And if you can leverage that to your advantage, it really is, it becomes a differentiator and a distinction. And I will say too, even today, right, we're everyone's pretty well-versed in marketing and, everyone can vibe code and such. But the reality is like AI and automation is on the rise at a feverish, uptick and sort of exponential curve. And our goal as employers and leaders is to really focus on upskilling our team and reskilling them so that they know how to approach this sort of new world, whether it's needed efficiency. And we take that time that we gain from efficiency and we put it into effectiveness. But either way, that's our big goal right now. So we're almost going back 20 years ago when the Reno Tahoe market didn't have, technologists. That's kind of how I look at the new world. Not everyone is, an AI guru. So how can we make our entire staff just that so that we can continue again with this purpose-based, principally led company, providing great brand experiences?
You're mentioning AI really made me think about this. So much of your company could be outsourced with AI.
Yes.
So many of your job titles are right up there in the top 10.
That's right.
AI are going to take,
That's right.
Especially anyone with content, have to have. So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, are you sitting there counting the number of employees you can get rid of and replace with a 5.0 subscription?
Yeah, I think it's a big question that's on everyone's mind is to like, will this disruption of this technology, net lose jobs or will they just convert jobs? I've always been a fan, and I've always said this before, there's more humans that are living on Earth than ever, and there's more people with jobs than there ever has been ever. And so, yes, this is one of those situations where you're like, well, this could be a little different. This is where the automation's, replacing some of these jobs, but I have to believe fundamentally that it's going to shift. It's just going to shift. Just like iron workers had to become steel workers, they had to reskill themselves. Same thing when like the internet came about, everyone had a travel agent, right? Everyone, those travel agents had to convert over to build websites like Kayak and Priceline and Expedia and TripAdvisor. And now look at those, they're huge employers, right? And they still are, even though we've democratized the travel planning experience. And so I have to believe, and I do believe in it, that, the work that we're putting out now, using these tools, using AI, is that much more impactful. It's that much more rich. It's that's more contextual. The work that we're putting out for brands, you can't just carbon copy that and give it to another brand. It's so specific and so relevant to that brand that it really can't live anywhere else. And so we're using tools. We're building our own LLMs. We're building our own notebook LLMs for our clients. We're building brand GPTs where we can actually drop in, the brand work and it validates and checks against brand standards. All this stuff would have been done with humans before, but now it takes humans to write these programs and to create these large, language models. And so I don't know. I'm an optimist. My glasses, I always say my beer is half full, because what you can get from a half full beer, you can get a nice little buzz off of it. So there's a value in there. But I guess my point is that, regardless, I do believe that if you stay close to the tip of the spear, you'll know where to point it. And ultimately, you'll find opportunity that's there. And so maybe we won't hire as many people, in the future, but the people we do have will be 3-4 times as impactful and that much more greater and smarter on how to attract our clients, you know, best customers that maybe they don't even know about yet.
I like that answer. Jared, we're out of time, I'm afraid. How do we find out more, follow you online, get in touch?
Yeah, thank you. I'm always on LinkedIn, doing a lot of thought leadership on there. So just go to LinkedIn, look for J-A-R-R-O-D, Lopiccolo, L-O-P-I-C-C-O-L-O. You know, send me a direct message. Let's talk. I always like to, you know, share knowledge. I like to give advice, but I also like to receive advice. And so hit me up there, and or you can go to our website, Noble Studios, NobleStudios.com. Take a look, see some case studies, read some stuff. If you like it, you know, reach out and we'll get connected.
Fantastic. Jared, thank you so much for being with us, and we'd love to have you back and watch you grow. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it.
And we'll be right back. Yes, I am very excited to introduce one of the smartest people in the world. He teaches at MIT. How could you get any smarter than that? Please welcome Don Kiefer to the show. He teaches operations management at MIT Sloan School of Management. He is the founder of Shift Gear Work Design, and he was the vice president of operational excellence for Harley-Davidson a couple of decades ago. Don, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Jim. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. Congratulations on the book. I didn't announce that yet. Let's make sure we go ahead and get it out. 5-star rated. There's got to be a better way how to deliver results and get rid of the stuff that gets in the way of real work. Congratulations.
Well, thank you for that.
Before we get on the book, let me ask a question about Harley-Davidson. I remember when I was in MBA school, we had a case about Harley-Davidson and studied how they had lost their way and the bikes were leaking and they lost sales and the Japanese were taking over. I know you were there after that, and I know you haven't been there for quite a while, but what was your experience at Harley? Were you the one fixing every single bike that was broken?
Actually, I was, Jim. I was single-handedly turned that company of 8,000 people, $5 billion. I turned it around myself, and it didn't take much at all.
Well, that's awesome. Did you ever read that case? Are you aware of the case I'm talking about?
Yeah, there were several cases. Yeah, and it's a fabulous story. Actually, I got there in 1989 when they had gone public. The owners, a couple of the managers had bought the company and were in the process of turning it around. It had just gone public. And in 1989, they had, I think, $400 million in sales. When I left 15 years later in 2004, it was $5 billion. So it was 15 years of 15% compound annual growth, and it was a very exciting time. And of course, there were hundreds and thousands of people and several key leaders that were part of the turnaround. I really worked in product development. I ran the engine project for the Twin Cam 88, which changed everything for the motorcycle. And then I ran the engine plant and was very involved in the product development. So that was my role, along with a lot of other people.
Well, it is an amazing story. And I love seeing an American brand come back and beat the Japanese and all of that. I used to live in Japan and worked for the Japanese government and for Coca-Cola in Japan. And despite all that, I like to see the Japanese come in second. So,
well, and I'm a big fan of Toyota being in manufacturing for so many decades.
Oh, but amazing.
It was nice to see that we were actually selling more heavyweight motorcycles in Japan than Honda was selling their Goldwing. So we even beat them on their own turf, which was, you know, it's a nice competition, but that was really gratifying to see. Yeah. For an American vehicle company in those years.
Japanese love Harley Davidson. They're in Shinjuku. There's a Harley Davidson merchandise store. I used to go there every Sunday as part of our brunch routine, and it was packed all the time, packed.
But you know, Jim, it's funny. In Japan, the culture is different. The beginners start out with a new bike. And as they get more and more into the sport, they spend more money on an older bike. So they have these, you know, they love the older ones. So the older the bike and the better shape it in, that was the culture that I knew, you know, 20 years ago in Japan.
What about the merchandise? Is merchandise a huge part of the Harley sales, $5 billion now? Because I see more merchandise than I do bikes.
Yeah, that's probably true. I don't think it's bigger, but it is certainly big. And I don't know the numbers that have been gone for 20 years, but when I was there, the parts and accessories business was, which includes the clothing, was a couple hundred million dollars easily. And it was a huge part of the dealers and a huge part of the culture.
Well, I've seen a lot of people wearing the gear that I know do not own a motorcycle. So
Jim, we had a saying about those people. Everything but the motorcycle. They had the jackets, the boots, the t-shirts from all over the place, but they didn't have a motorcycle. But they were in there with the fake tattoos, and they were part of the conversation. Yeah, it was great.
Oh, that's funny. All right, let's get back to the future. I mean, to the present. Tell us about the book. There's got to be a better way. What was the impetus behind this? Where did this come from?
Well, Nelson, my co-author, who is an actual MIT professor, I'm more of a factory rat who's now a senior lecturer there, but we met in 1996, and we were both super interested in changing organizations and making work better, and we hit it off right away. So we've had a 30-year collaboration of me doing stuff, and then Nelson and I both thinking about it, what works, what didn't work, and then trying again. And we've done this for, all, as I said, over 30 years, and about halfway through, we figured out, hey, we're doing something different here, something pretty cool, and we'd like to record it. Took us a long time to get to the book, I'm sorry to say, but I think we did finally get it right on their approach to actually changing work.
So, you know, I interview a lot of people who come up with new methodologies, new systems. And in my back of my head, I'm going, oh, this is awesome. No one's ever going to do this, though. You know, do you see that with me, that there's a lot of new systems and leadership models and things that come out and peter away and go away and never actually get integrated anywhere?
We do. And actually, this was the subject of Nelson's PhD in the study, is why don't all these programs work? And there's a lot of reasons. He knows all the psychological reasons and the dynamics. But basically, if you take one practice from one company and try to install it in another, especially in a big initiative with program, with coffee cups, banners, training centers, and expensive hotels, it very rarely works, because the change has really got to fit the environment, and it's got to start on the ground floor, in our view.
Okay. Why is that more likely to integrate? Is it because it started at the ground floor? You know, the Japanese term nemawashi, everyone talks about it before anyone does anything.
Well, there's certainly a lot of that in the businesses today.
Well, maybe there should be more.
Well, we should get everyone on board with it before we do it, certainly, but instead of just a top down. But the way we work is we say, start with a small piece of a big problem and go find out what's really happening and fix the work. Don't just assume it's people don't know what they're doing and give them training or some new technology. Actually, people do know what they're doing and they're trying hard to get it done. So go remove the barriers, understand the work, and do it in a small space. The value of that is that leaders get connected with the work and the people. They put points on the board and the people actually like it better because now they can do more work. And so they start talking about it and they say, hey, you did that for them. How about for me? So it starts to spread naturally. But just imagine this, Jim. You get people coming to ask you, hey, make me more productive too. I want to work that way. It's just, it's a way different. A way different way of doing change than trying with these big programs to push down new words and technology that people don't really get. And oftentimes just layer problems on top of problems. They don't really fix the core work.
Can you give me one of the examples and implementation that worked out?
Oh, we've got so many. I'll tell you one from a financial private equity group. This was one of our students in the executive MBA program, and he's going through 2 years of an executive MBA, and he's in our class called Organizations Lab, and he's seeing some of the tools we use, the visual tools and the quick fixes. And he grabs me at lunchtime. He says, Don, maybe you can help me. I just don't see how my problem fits into this. So we go in a room to a whiteboard. His basic problem is he's doing private equity. He's building funds. So the funds last 5 years. So people join and they pay out. And this company has to now find investors for the next five-year fund. He says, I get this guy that is not finding enough investment for the funds. He's like underfunding like by 25, 30%. And every time I ask him what's going on, he says, don't worry, I got it. He says, I want to know how to fix this. So I showed him, I drew it on the whiteboard, a simple graphic of take Post-it notes, what are the different stages of these different investors? Like, we're talking to them, they're in conversation, they committed or whatever. So you can see kind of the pipeline investment coming and get it out of the stories and get them to show you the actual activities that are going on. He calls me 6 months later. He says, well, I had to fire that guy because he didn't want to do my work, do the work the way I wanted him to. And he wasn't being successful. And he just refused to try this method. He said, but I tried it and we tripled the amount of investment in the funds. And it happened time and time again. And it was just with the stupid post-it notes, he told us, and the whiteboard. So he said, now my whole company wants to start working this way. What's the secret? What's the big deal?
Did I miss the change that was implemented?
Yeah, we just had to get it from stories like, don't worry, Jim, I got it, I'm handling it, to say, write a post-it note with every investor, how much you're talking to them about, and what stage of the negotiation, put it on the wall so we can see the state, see if you've got enough hooks in the water, see if you're talking to enough people, what the problems are, so we can see it and get it out of your head. So this making that invisible intellectual work visible allow them to manage it way better.
Yeah, that's a simple tool that all salespeople are supposed to use, right?
Correct.
Some sort of tracking.
I'll tell you, if you have time for one more story, yeah. I'll tell you another one.
Stories are radio.
So we had there was a doctor, one of our students, and she was working in the cancer field. And one of the problems was it took so long to get the drugs because they would test their DNA and they would develop this specific drug and then get the drug to the person. The timeline for that was so long that people were dying before they got the drugs. So she went in to investigate what was really going on. And the problem was at the first stage. The old computer form that they were using said, we need X amount of biological sample from the patient. And it was like, okay, we need like 3 tubes worth of samples. And then the process had gotten so complex with the new DNA technologies that they actually needed 6 or 7. So the fourth person would say, oh, there's no more sample left. So they had to go back to the patient again and start over again. And the sixth one again. And she said it was a stupid change on the computer to get enough samples in the beginning. And she said, here's how many lives we've saved. We shortened the time frame by X amount of months. And we've saved, 30% more lives doing this because it was just the pull down menu on the stupid computer that people never thought about.
Okay. Wow, that's a simple change to save so many lives. That's kind of embarrassing, I would think, that they hadn't figured that out.
You're right, Jim. In fact, we have a saying, if you go down to really investigate what's really happening, not what you think is happening, if you're not embarrassed by what you find, you're not looking closely enough.
I would think that's probably true. So what is the magic sauce then? So when they came back and said, we want the rest of the business to operate this way, what did you do then? You couldn't just go look for another pull down.
No, it was the method. Pick a small piece of an important problem, go investigate thoroughly and discover. So it was the method of like getting leaders engaged with the real frontline work and what all the problems people had to work around to get their jobs done and solving the problem. Rather than sitting around an office looking at numbers that were 30 years, 60 years, 90 days old and trying to guess what was wrong from their experience. It's like, put all that away, go see what people are really struggling with and fix it. And the idea, Jim, is like, get the work moving. It's not about people's attitudes or if they're engaged or whatever. It's about, is the work moving and are people able to do the work they're paid to do? And once you see the work moving and resolve the problems, you actually do see the morale goes up. People are super engaged. They love their work because now they can actually go home saying, hey, work was hard, but we got something done today. So I think it's more the method than one technical trick.
Yes. Well, I like that focus deep, deep, deep on one small thing. That makes a lot of sense. So, is that repeatable though? I mean, is that something that I can charge $100,000 for and walk in and say, all we have to do is focus on one tiny little thing really deep? Am I going to get $100,000?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that. We do have 5 principles that we've put together based on our 30 years of experience. It's like, why do all these things work? Like, why does Toyota Production System work? Why does Agile work? Why does Total Quality System work? because people are focused on the practices, just go do this, go do this. And what we want to do is change the way they think about the work and the design of the work. So we came up with five principles and the approach of Start Small. So we go looking at that work with a certain lens, like, are the targets in place? Do people understand the intent? Are people connected the right way? Is there too much work in the system? Are we even talking about the right problem? Or are we just saying the problem is we need a new IT system, which is actually a solution? So it's a very kind of structured way of thinking about the work, which turns on a whole engine of let's solve the right problem at the right time.
You know, we hear all of these stories about Elon Musk sleeping on the factory floor and things like that. And I don't know how much of that's myth and how much of it's true, but I have heard that he is on the floor, on the factory floor very frequently and makes decisions very quickly. Is that an example of this?
It is. And I'm in the middle of reading his biography, and there's a lot of things he does that are great. And there's a lot of things that he does, which I wouldn't want to do, which is a huge risk taker. He'll bet everything.
Do you want 14 children?
Oh, no.
9 different women?
No. And he's got Asperger's or some, you know, mental condition, which says he's not that great with getting along with people. And he screams and yells a lot, but he's got a clear focus, and he's a smart guy. He's educated guy, engineering, technical person. So the thing that his people love is, one, is that he supports them. So if there's an issue, he will come down and get in the middle and help solve the problem. He'll bring the resources there. He won't blame them. I mean, sometimes he fires a lot of people because he's kind of a crazy guy, but his knowledge and willingness to get into the problem and actually solve the problem, that's what his people love about him. And that is a good piece of what he does.
Very interesting. We only have about a minute left, Don. What else do we want to say?
We want to say, if you work this method, for me, running factories my whole life, working in factories my whole life, it was like playing a game of whack-a-mole. It was like the same old problems come up day after day after day. Once I got the hang of this, which I learned partly from some Toyota guys and partly from others and partly on my own. Once I got the hang of this framework, my entire life changed. And so did the life of my professional life and my people. Now work became a cross between solving a jigsaw puzzle, find the corners, find the edge piece, find all the oranges. Let's fix this thing and make progress in a board game. It's exciting. Who's going to win? So we're not just solving the same old problems anymore. We could find innovation in the oldest technology. We could make progress. We could compete. And I think that's the reason I keep doing it instead of sitting around on Social Security drinking beer on the back porch, is that it really makes work life way better. Not only does it make organizations more effective, help the customers more, put profits on the bottom line, it's a much, much better way to work. So there's got to be a better way. There actually is a better way.
Are you able to afford anything nicer than PBR on a Social Security pension? Pabst Blue Ribbon? Is that not the cheapest beer on earth? I don't drink beer, so I don't know.
No, Braumeister, I think, is the cheapest. That's what my dad used to drink. But yeah. Oh, yeah. So I got my Harley pension, which I can afford to drink beer.
You go. Don, how do we find out more and get a copy of the book?
It's available on Amazon. There's got to be a better way. And you can just Google me or Nelson Don Kiefer at mit.edu or email me and you can find out more.
Fantastic. Don, thanks for being with us, and I will look forward to speaking with Nelson in a week or two.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me, Jim.
Thank you, and we will be right back. Bye, bye, bye! With us, it turns out that today is World Mental Health Day. Actually, October 10th, World Health Day. I think that's today. We're excited to talk about it either way. We have Dr. Brittany Albright with us. She is a Harvard-trained, double board certified addiction specialist. She is also the founder of Sweetgrass Psychiatry, and she has with her Ben, an IT consultant. Dr. Albright, welcome. How are you doing today?
Thank you, Jim. I am doing well, and I'm so thrilled to be here with you this morning with Ben on behalf of Johnson & Johnson.
So tell us about Mental Health Day.
Mental health day deserves a full year, not just one day. It is every bit as critical as physical health. They're actually completely intertwined. And today I'm really excited to talk with you alongside Ben about major depressive disorder.
Okay, what is that? I've not heard of that.
Depression is a constellation of symptoms and a few of the symptoms that folks commonly experience. And keep in mind that this has to occur for at least 2 weeks or more. It's not just fleeting thoughts of sadness. It's persistent feelings of either sadness or numbness, feeling down, losing interest in things that you normally love. It's decreased energy. People often describe having brain fog, sometimes feeling irritable. It often accompanies anxiety. Also, people experience difficulties with sleep, appetite changes, sometimes feelings of worthlessness, and sometimes feelings that they'd be better off not alive anymore.
And what do we do in this circumstance? Is therapy needed? Medication?
There's no one size fits all, and that's part of the challenge of this disorder. And that's why Ben and I are here to convey hope and the fact that there are some new treatment options. Historically, we've always recommended psychotherapy, which I still do. I'm such a big believer in psychotherapy. But then often we resort to pills, to antidepressants, which can have a whole host of side effects that I know Ben will talk about. But when patients have tried two or more oral antidepressants and are not getting relief from these crippling depression symptoms, we call that treatment-resistant depression. The reality is it's not actually treatment-resistant. We have new options, and one of those options is Spravato, which was FDA-approved in 2019.
Okay, I have not heard of that drug. Spravato, you said?
Spravato, I know it's a neat name, and actually it's spelled S-P-R-A-V-A-T-O. And actually, to learn more, folks can speak with their healthcare provider or go to Spravato.com. But it actually has a completely different mechanism of action than traditional antidepressants. It works on the neurotransmitter called glutamate in the brain. And it's not a pill you take every day. It's actually a nasal spray that patients self-administer in a certified treatment center. The generic name is S-ketamine. It's extremely safe. There's no shots, no injections. It's just a simple nasal spray. Most patients have minimal to no side effects, but there are a few potential side effects, the most common being what's called dissociation or a light floaty feeling. Also, there are some box warnings such as sedation, respiratory depression, risk for abuse and misuse because it is a controlled medication. But that's also why we require patients to receive this treatment in a certified treatment center.
Ben, what are you here to talk about today? Can we hear some of your story?
Sure, absolutely. I'm here to talk about my experience with treatment-resistant depression and a piece of my treatment, important piece of my treatment has been Spravato. And it's something I'm so passionate to talk about now, which is ironic because when I was depressed, I wasn't able to talk about it. But that human connection is so important because I learned those who shared their stories with me helped me out so much. And I want to share my story with others. And my treatment-resistant depression story is the symptoms Dr. Albright mentioned are so profound because they culminate over time and build on top of one another. The numbness, the exhaustion is like something I never felt before. Losing interest in hobbies made me feel like a shell of a human because those hobbies, my interests, my passions, those make me who I am, right? And if I'm not excited about my job and career anymore, I'm not excited about running and cooking and hanging out with friends and creative writing, I'm losing who I am and I'm losing the hope of the future. And I'm like, what's the point of this all? And it got so bad over the weeks, months, and years of living through depression. Most of the time I didn't realize But when I got to the point where I couldn't get out of bed for days, I couldn't brush my teeth, my family had to order me dinners because I wasn't eating, I couldn't get out of my apartment, my family really helped me get into therapy. And going into therapy and working with my psychiatrist was a huge piece. And the treatment-resistant depression part is I went through about 10 different antidepressants. And for listeners who don't understand, the antidepressant kind of routine is you start from a low dose and you slowly ramp up week to week till you get to a dosage that should be making an impact. And that's typically about 8 weeks in. And if it's not working, you ramp down over weeks and you kind of start over. Treatment-resistant depression, you don't get any of the benefits of those antidepressants that you're taking. I unfortunately got most of the side effects to the point where I couldn't leave my apartment just on the side effects alone. So had to deal with the depression, had to deal with the intrusive thoughts, the wanting to die. And now I have all these physical side effects. My psychiatrist diagnosed me with treatment-resistant depression. And at first, I was terrified because that sounded like, hey, you have no options. It's treatment-resistant.
That's exactly
resistant.
What it sounds like. Yeah.
Right? Yeah. It's terrified. But the more I learned about it, I'm like, oh, millions of people are going through this. And there are these new options like Spravato that my sister actually introduced me to. And I raised it with my psychiatrist that are specifically for individuals like me. So it turned from this terror to hope, where I started reading patient testimonies on Spravato, and I'm like, let's do this. Let's rock and roll, man. I am so ready to become me again. And throughout the process of therapy, having an amazing support system of friends and family, and going through treatments, Spravato was a piece of the puzzle that really helped me troubleshoot myself and utilize the tools therapy gave me to help take those steps forward. Because depression isn't healed. It doesn't go away. There's not a cure for it. You learn how to work with it and you improve. Seriously, every single day you will improve. And it's been a ride, and I feel really happy where I am right now.
You sound it, Ben. You sound very happy. I can't imagine that you would ever been depressed. You sound ecstatic.
That makes me happy to hear that, because I'm currently in the apartment where I lived through the worst of my depression. And this floor just right next to me was my sleeping spot. I'd crawl into my sleeping bag head first with a bottle of scotch. And unfortunately, I'm an expensive drinker, so I'd get a nice bottle of scotch. And I would just drink it, crying. And I would get chest pains, Jim. And my dad passed away from a heart attack, and I'd lay on the floor with chest pains. And I said, I don't care. I just don't care. And then my cat would come and rub against my face. And I'm like, no, I care for this little guy. And I have friends and family that really love me and care about me too. And I'm doing this for them. I'm doing this for myself to improve.
Excellent. Well, you sound happy now, and thank God for cats and dogs. They are great when you are down. I have experienced the love of some animals myself. Dr. Albright, we only have about a minute left. Where do we go to find out more and get information?
I echo that, Jim. Pets are just the very best healers, and so are fellow humans. Like, I'm looking at Ben right now on the screen, and just seeing tears in his eyes brings tears to my eyes too, just to know that he is living such a full life right now. He's actually working on a book. He loves to surf. He loves movies. And that's why I love my job as a psychiatrist. And that's also why I'm such a passionate prescriber of Spravato, because I have seen these treatments restore lives and restore hope. And so my take-home messages to all the listeners is, number one, check on your people. Check on yourself. If you're feeling these feelings, it's not normal, and please seek help. But most of all, I want to convey empathy to everyone listening in. I want to convey hope. This is not your fault. And like Ben said, you are not alone. There's millions of people struggling with major depression and treatment-resistant depression in particular. do your homework too. Talk to your healthcare provider, but also research new treatment options that are safe, effective, and FDA approved, such as Spravato. Go to Spravato.com to learn more. And then, especially if you're having thoughts of self-harm, suicidal thoughts, please, 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 your life is so precious. Go to 988. Dial that number, text that number, because help is here.
Ben, just to let you know, I own a publishing company and I would love to publish your book for you. Dr. Albright, thank you so much for being with us. Ben, thank you so much. We'd love to have you back.
Jim, I'm going to hold you to that now. Thank you so much. This has been absolutely amazing.
Dr. Albright, thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
We're out of time. Hope you had a good day. Take care. Bye now.